91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's an At Your Service edition devoted to heart disease research, new surgical techniques, and prevention measures. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Heart disease remains the leading cause of death among Americans, yet a recent survey finds that misunderstanding persists. Today's guests include Dr. Ramon Quesada, the Medical Director of Interventional Cardiology, Cardiac Research, and Structural Heart Program at Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute at Baptist Hospital, and Dr. Edward Savage, Chairman of the Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery, Center Director for the Heart and Vascular Institute at Cleveland Clinic, Florida. Of course, we'll be taking listener calls. Topical Currents, at your service, after the news. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman back with today's Topical Currents. Glad you could join us. Today's focus is on heart disease and how the latest medical research and technology aids patients. We call on leading experts from two regional hospitals to share their expertise.
And we'll also talk about heart health. We'll also take your calls during the hour, but first it's Dr. Ramon Quesada, the Medical Director of Interventional Cardiology, Cardiac Research, and Structural Heart Program at the Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute at Baptist Hospital. Talk about. Welcome to you, Dr. Quesada.
Thank you.
Good to have you.
My pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Doctor. Also with us is Dr. Edward Savage, Chairman of the Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery, Center Director for the Heart and Vascular Institute at Cleveland Clinic, Florida. Welcome to you, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
So a bit later, we'll meet a patient who will speak with his experience of undergoing quintuple bypass surgery last year. And, of course, that's Paul Lipton.
We'll get to him in just a little while. But first, let's start with you, Dr. Savage. Before we delve into the latest innovations in the treatment of heart disease, I want to consider that new national survey conducted by your institution, Cleveland Clinic, that indicated Americans have misconceptions about heart disease, its cause, its risk factors, and just as importantly, how to maintain heart health. So if you could elaborate on some of those findings.
Sure. As an introduction to that whole thing, when I get asked to talk about prevention of heart disease, the first thing I tell people is that I'm not going to tell you anything you don't already know. We're inundated with it in various types of programs and such. But the real question is, do you pay attention and do you heed it? And so what this survey did is it actually looked at certain aspects to find out if people really knew their numbers and were listening. So the question was, did you know your blood pressure? Well, it turns out that fewer than 50% of people even knew what their blood pressure was. And then another question was, do you know what your BMI is, or your body mass index, which is a measurement of how overweight you might be.
Unfortunately, I do.
How is that determined, though? I mean, is it a test the doctor gives you?
No, actually, you can do it yourself. It's based on your weight and your height.
Okay.
And you can just look up BMI and Google it, and you can get a calculator online. You enter your height and you enter your weight, and make sure it's your real height and your real weight.
And how much is it supposed to be?
It should be ideally less than 25.
Okay.
Now, that said, if you're a really muscular person, you're going to have a high BMI, but not necessarily be overweight. But most of us are going to fall into that range where the BMI is going to give us some idea of where we are. There's other numbers such as your lipids. We talk about lipids and lipid levels, and we have all these drugs to treat lipids. And people don't even know what their lipid levels are, what their cholesterol is. The other thing, too, is what's their blood sugar. They don't necessarily even know what their blood sugar is. So the real message from this study is that even though all this information is out there, people aren't paying attention.
Obviously, there are modifiable causes of heart disease, and there are unmodifiable ones like heredity, I guess.
Correct.
So which are more responsible for heart disease being the number one cause of death in the United States and around the world? Is it the ones that we can't control or the ones that we can control and we don't?
So I can't quote you an exact number.
Okay.
But most of the patients who have heart disease have these risk factors. And we know that it's been increasing, and people aren't necessarily...
The modifiable ones.
The modifiable ones, yes. There are some people who come in who are young, who have heart disease, who I have to do bypass surgery on, or Dr. Quesada has to do stents on, who have a clear hereditary component. There's a young man I knew, in his 40s, who was on the treadmill the other day, and I said, "What are you doing on the treadmill?" He runs marathons. He said, "Well, my father, my uncle, my brother, they all had heart attacks in their 40s, so I'm checking myself out." But that's probably the minority, and we can't blame our heredity for it. Plus, even if we have a hereditary predisposition,
can you override that with good health?
You can't
health?
Necessarily override it, but why do we add on the extra risk of these modifiable factors? You can still modify it. You may delay it. You may reduce it. So that's why, even if you have a hereditary predisposition, you still got to know your numbers.
The survey also found that many people are completely unaware of the relationship between heart disease and diabetes.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And diabetes is a real problem in this country, as we know. And most of the diabetes problems here are related to not just obesity, but bad diet. We eat the wrong things, so our blood sugars are high. And the more fat that your body stores in it, the more chances you have of developing what's called metabolic abnormalities. The most extreme is a metabolic syndrome, and maybe Dr. Quesada knows a little bit more about this than I do, because he deals with more of this, perhaps. But you develop a metabolic abnormalities. And so one of the best ways to reduce your risks is just by reducing your blood sugars and your diabetes. And it's been clearly documented that in people who lose weight, who had required medications to control their blood sugar, or people who are extremely overweight, who have gastric surgery to reduce their body mass, clearly can have a reduction in their blood sugar, come off those medications, and actually do much better.
Dr. Ramon Quesada, tell us what's going on at Cleveland Clinic, Florida, and some of your specialties and some of the technology that
he's at Baptist.
I'm sorry, with Baptist and Pioneering.
So I think the most important is, as it was mentioned by Dr. Savage, is the prevention part. So when prevention fails, is when the intervention or surgery comes on. So if we can really do a population modification on health, it is the most important aspect. But interventional cardiology or minimally invasive procedures have changed the way we deal when the prevention fails. And the new technology has improved us, the outcome of patients who have severe coronary and cardiac disease in general. So what is new? So in the coronary revascularization, I'm talking about interventional aspects, is there are new devices that will be the future, like stents that are not going to be called stents anymore. They're going to be called what they are, scaffolds, that they go away with time.
So
In other words. So the artery remains intact with all the functions that and responses to our own control of the tone of the arteries.
Can I ask a question about these absorbable stents? Because I'm a little confused. If stents help keep coronary arteries open and reduce the chance of a heart attack, right? What are the advantages of a stent that's biodegradable and it's absorbed by the body? How does the artery stay open once it's been absorbed?
So, first of all, the initial event that happens, atherosclerosis is a diffuse process. It's not a focal process. So what we've been treating when there's a focal obstruction with the stents is only a part of the whole process. You had to treat atherosclerosis itself. So how do you do that? First of all, it's an inflammatory process. So you have to stop the inflammatory process, to change the constitution of the plaques that you have. But saying that, when you put a stent, the stent with medication, that's the one we use today, what it does is reduce the incidence of reobstruction for scar tissue formation. but you still are left with a metal inside the artery.
Right.
So the response to your own substances that you produce to regulate the tone of the arteries and how the artery dilates and constricts during different situations is affected by this metal. What about if you get rid of the metal once the artery heals and the artery reestablishes the whole function? So that has to be tested over time. This is what we know now so far. That when you compare in arteries that are normal size vessels, that you compare using the drug-eluting stents, that's what we use today, to stents that absorb, there is no difference. We think that the difference is going to come 3, 5, 10 years after you have the stent, in regard that the artery will recover its function, and hopefully you have impacted the evolution of the atherosclerosis in your own body, so you don't have progression of the disease. If you apply prevention, statins, control your numbers, as it was mentioned before, and that is what, at the end of the day, will impact the outcome in the long term.
But they haven't been around very long. So do you know really over the long term what they'll do, these absorbent ones?
This is a very good point. We have done the studies so far comparing in the short term. In the long term, we have waiting for the longer-term results. So we know now for fact that are as effective as the metal stents with drugs, and in the short term. In the long term, because the drug, the stent will, or the scaffold will disappear, then the impact on the natural history of the disease will be probably better. We have to prove that. We haven't proved that.
You mentioned plaques. Define that for us.
Well, the obstruction of the arteries are formed because you develop plaques. Plaques is the atheroma, which is a term that we call atherosclerosis, which is the arteries itself are not tubes. They are glands, basically, that respond to substances that we all produce to control the tone of the arteries. That's basically. So what happens is when you have high cholesterol, high blood pressure, all the risk factors that we've been talking about, diabetes, the first thing that happens is that the arteries in the body, and not only in the coronary arteries, they start responding in the same way. And there's a medical term for that. We call it endothelium dysfunction, which the artery now, the same substances that produce the dilatation of the artery now produce constriction of the artery. And that change of behavior of our own arteries damage this endothelium and produce the plaques. Those plaques are full of bad things like cholesterol. And then when the plaque rupture, like a volcano, all the substances that are inside that plaque, it triggers an acute thrombosis or formation of clots that occludes the artery. And that gives you a heart attack. And that can be reproduced in all parts of the body. You can have a stroke, which is is similar to a heart attack, but in the brain. So it's part of the same process. It's not a focal effect. So how can we change that? What we are doing with intervention is only treating the failure of something that is bigger than that, which is the prevention of the disease in the first place.
Right. We're speaking about innovations in interventional cardiac procedures and management of risk factors for heart disease with Dr. Ramon Quezada. And Dr. Ramon Quezada is with Baptist Health South Florida. Also, Dr. Edward Savage with us, who's with Cleveland Clinic, Florida. And Paul Lipton will join us when we come back from this break.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman back with today's topical currents. We resume our conversation with Dr. Ramon Quezada, the Medical Director of Interventional Cardiology Cardiac Research at Baptist Hospital. Also with Dr. Edward Savage, Chairman of the Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery at Cleveland Clinic, Florida. Bonnie.
And we want to bring in Paul Lipton, who had quintuple, that's five, bypass surgery just last year. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
I mean, you've been on our program before. I was so shocked to hear that you, of all people, who had made all these changes in life, from going from a high-powered attorney to a truth seeker, not that attorneys don't seek the truth sometimes, but okay.
And an author.
And an author, and so many of your adventures as part of this ageless experiment and your book, Hour of the Wolf. What happened?
Great question. I live in Boulder. And I decided, since I moved to Boulder, to go to a cardiologist, to have a cardiologist on call in case. I had no symptoms. I go to CrossFit pretty much every day, work out, ride my motorcycle, do all that, eat right. Went to the cardiologist. He said, "You're in great shape. Let me listen." And he literally said, "I hear something." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I just hear something doesn't sound right to me. I want to do..."
He was listening to your heart.
Yes. He said he had that stethoscope. He was listening.
Yeah. Okay.
And it was that. And he said, "I'd like to do a scan, a heart scan." I said, "Okay."
Probably an echocardiogram.
Right. Yes. And he did that. I got a call. He said, "Your LAD, the Widowmaker." He said, "The Widowmaker artery is 99% blocked."
99.
And 99. And I said, "How can that be?" I said, "I'm fine." And he said, "You've just adjusted somehow to using 1%. And I said, "What do you want to do?" And he said, "We need to go in." I went in for a stent, but when I woke up, the angle was such that the stent couldn't go in. And I came out, I said, "We done?" And he said, "I got news for you." He said, "Couldn't get the stent in because of the angle. We got to go in." I said, "When?" He said, "Immediately." And so I had no symptoms. My take is that my father died of a heart attack when he was young. My grandfather died of a heart attack when he was young. So I think it, for me...
Young meaning like under 50?
In the 50, mm-hmm. early 60s, and my dad 50, 55. So I think that for me it was hereditary, because I eat right and I exercise, et cetera. So for me it was hereditary. And but for his comment, I asked the doctors, his comment was basically, "Paul, you wouldn't have a heart attack. One day you'll be at CrossFit and just drop dead." Yeah. He said, "So I'm glad you came in." And I'm glad he took the time to just, it was nothing fancy about it. I mean, he was just listening, and he said, "I hear something." And it was that started me on the journey to a quintuple bypass.
Dr. Quezada, your comments on that story.
So it's it's very interesting, but that's the natural history of this disease. So you have a patient who has no symptoms yet has diffuse inflammatory process of all the arteries of the heart, hardening the arteries.
But so, he said only one artery was blocked.
He got killed, no?
I had 99% in one, then one was 70% blocked, two were 50% blocked.
Ah, okay, so there
But it was the 99 that was the one that got my attention.
So you know, one of the things that is fascinating really is that if you look at the last century, and I'm talking about 20th century, and you look at it, what are the most important changes in medicine? If you quantify the life saved, one was antibiotics, Fleming, penicillin, and the second one was statins. Because patients who have familial dyslipidemia, that's the medical term, or have genetically prone to have severe atherosclerosis, and for them, sudden cardiac death and coronary disease, et cetera, being the number one cause of death, now, with the statins, which is an enzyme that helps to metabolize cholesterol, you can bring the risk of coronary artery disease or atherosclerosis down. And you can have an impact in long-term survival. And you can modify lifestyle. We learn all that. Eisenhower was president. He had some pain in the chest. He was playing golf in Colorado, and they gave him a scotch, put him in bed. They did an EKG, and he was having a heart attack. But in those days...
That's all you could do.
It's all you could do. They put him in bed for 3 months, and that was it. You know, and this was in in the last 60, 70 years. You know, so everything have changed. If you go further back, Charles IV or the II of England have the same symptoms, and they put him in bed for 3 months, and he died of probably a pulmonary embolism or a clot in the lungs or whatever. In 400 years, the treatment of heart attack didn't change until the last 50, 40 years. Yeah. So when you talk about innovation, the learning about the disease, I think, was the most important thing. And by learning the disease, it brought up all the innovation on how do we treat it, cardiac surgery. You know, if you go to the and revascularization with minimal procedures and new stents and new devices. So we have come a long way since the beginning.
So I make a comment? It's really, you know, Paul, you bring up a really important point. You're in good shape. I mean, I'm looking at you. You look like you take care of yourself. You had a hereditary problem. You didn't have any symptoms. And that is the real issue, is that you don't necessarily have to have symptoms. Now, so for example, we talk classically about chest pain. Everybody who's old enough remembers Fred Sanford with the heart on the chest. I'm coming, Elizabeth. But I'll walk into the office and I'll talk to patients and they'll say, are you having chest pain? No, I don't get chest pain. Well, what do they get? What they get is heaviness, numbness in their arm, tingling in their jaw, pain in their back. All of these can be symptoms. Other people are just tired. They just, you know, I'm done by noon. I can't do anymore. I got to get stuff done by noon if I can't. These are all signs of heart disease, shortness of breath. But you can actually work through shortness of breath because your heart's good at adapting. So, like, you might start out with an activity and you'd be like, wow, I'm really short of breath, but then you recover and you're okay because your heart adapts. But that's still having, you can still have the heart disease. That's why, that's why it's really important, even if you don't necessarily have risk factors, to get screened. You know, you can do the CT scans to look for calcium scores. Those don't really tell you whether or not you have critical coronary disease. They just tell you if you have a risk factor for it. But stress tests, and what they do with a stress test is they do some sort of exercise, if you can exercise, like get on a treadmill and look at the changes in the electrical forces in your heart. Or sometimes we do it with nuclear scanning, where you can see where the nuclear dye does not get into the heart across the board, and that tells you what the risks are and the risk factors. So that's probably the most, if nobody takes anything else away from this program, the thing to take away is that just because you're not having the classic symptoms doesn't mean that you don't have heart disease.
So what are the best screens for heart disease, other than getting all the blood work that we talked about and knowing what that blood work means? And
when they should they occur?
So if you go to see your cardiologist and there's a concern, they're going to do an exam. First thing, I don't know what he heard. It's unusual to hear anything with coronary disease. But if you have valvular heart disease, they're going to hear abnormalities. Mm-hmm. All right. Like, we call them murmurs. And what murmurs are is the turbulence in the blood as it goes through a valve, or if it's pushed back through a valve. And that'll be a sign. So if you hear a murmur, you're going to get what's called an echocardiogram. And that looks, it takes a picture of the function of the heart muscle. It takes a picture of the function of the heart valve. You might get a stress test. If you get an executive physical, I had an executive physical last year. Part of that was a routine stress test, because you can detect ischemic coronary disease in a lot of patients just by doing that stress test, by having them exercising and see what happens. We've had some patients who've come into the office for a stress test, and we say, you're going to the ER. We're going to get a cath
on
you.
Yeah, I was just
going
to say, like, how many of them go right to surgery?
Not a lot, but we've had a few.
If I could follow up on that, it's you're absolutely right, because for me, it was so critical to just go for a regular checkup. And I learned a couple of things. One thing I learned was, and doctors, maybe you could tell me if I'm right or not, how you go into the surgery is how you come out of the surgery. By that I mean, because I work out and exercise, the doctors told me I recovered quicker, because I was just healthier in working out.
Well,
and
there's actually two aspects to that. And so the first is your physical status. You know, the worse you're, and there's, I'm going to call it three aspects. One is your physical status. Do you exercise? The next is your nutritional status. we have this thing in heart surgery called the obesity paradox. And that is, if you're somewhat overweight when you go into surgery, you actually have a better outcome. And the reason is because you don't eat for a while, you lose weight. So if you're really skinny and you have no reserves, you actually do worse. So that's one check mark plus for being a little overweight.
Especially in old age.
Especially in old age. And probably the most common area is with elderly women who are very thin and don't have much fat reserve. But the third is attitude. All right? Is attitude. If you don't go in there with a good attitude, with a positive attitude. So, for example, I'll have a patient who'll come into the office, and an older person, and they need a lot. They need a big operation. And I say, do you want to do this? They say, well, my kids want me to do it. I say, it's not your kids who have to go through it. You have to want to do it. You have to have the attitude to get through this procedure.
Luckily, Paul is the Olympic winner of an attitude.
Well, that's why I thought he'd appreciate that comment just in the short time we've met.
It's absolutely true because as Bonnie and Joe know, I'm a very positive thinking person, and I said, let's just do it. And I said, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. And when I woke up from it, I said to the doctor, by the way, just so I can say it, my cardiologist in Boulder was Dr. Doucette, and the surgeon was Dr. Mahan. They were both wonderful and very caring people.
All right, that's Paul Lipton, who went through quintuple bypass last year. Patient, but we're also with Dr. Edward Savage of the Cleveland Clinic, Florida, and Dr. Ramon Quesada of Cardiac and Vascular Institute of Baptist Hospital. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take some calls and some emails. Stay with us.
And we return. It's today's Topical Currents at your service. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Of course, our topic today is heart disease and the medical research and technology and also prevention of heart disease. If you'd like to join in, our number 1-800-743-9576. We have some lines open. It also might be faster if you email. Bonnie will read those. radio@wlrn.org. It's essential that you keep those emails short. No essays, please, Bonnie.
Okay. Dr. Quesada, I wanted to, because we haven't talked about it yet, for you to tell us about TAVR. Transcatheter aortic valve replacement, which is not as invasive a procedure, correct?
Correct. So the replacement of the aortic valve in patients who have obstruction of the aortic valve is being a surgical procedure. It is a surgical procedure in patients who are low risk for surgery. But the patients who are elderly, frail, and have multiple comorbidities where surgery became a very, very high risk, those patients doing this TAVI or TAVR, TAVR or transcatheter aortic valve replacement has changed their outcome, has improved survival. So there's no medical therapy for a mechanical problem. When the blood cannot come out of the heart, like an aortic stenosis or obstruction of the aortic valve, there is no medication that will help you except replacing the valve. And the only way to do this was doing open heart surgery. What about if we can do this without surgery, through catheters? With the patient nowadays, 90% of the cases that we're doing today are with only sedation, without general anesthesia. And that's one of the major changes in cardiovascular treatment, or cardiovascular disease in the last 15 years. And the fact of the matter that was approved by the FDA initially for patients who were extreme high risk for surgery or inoperable, and for high risk, and now is comparable in patients with the intermediate risk, is make a big change in the way we treat patients. I think this is the beginning of a new era in the treatment of cardiovascular diseases.
If somebody were healthy and a candidate for open heart surgery, if they were a candidate, would that still be the best route to go or are the other procedures just as successful?
I think if the patient is what we consider low risk for surgery and young,
right.
and age becomes a very important aspect,
right.
younger patients should have surgery.
Okay.
And one of the reasons is because we know Dr. Savage can talk more about this, is that we have a long-term evolution with the valve. We know how the valves can last. We still don't know how the valves that we put through catheters are going to last. So if it's a young patient, I had a patient that came for TAVI. It's a 56-year-old patient. Absolutely not. The patient should have surgery. I cannot tell this patient, your valve is going to last 20 years. From surgery, we know the evolution, the duration of the valves.
Now, with the catheter aspect, though, it mentioned that you go through the femoral artery. That's a long highway, isn't it?
Actually, it's a short highway.
Short, really?
Yes. Or say it's a direct. It's the procedure has becoming. Then when we started this 12 years ago to what we are doing today, has been a significant evolution in technology. And the profile of the tube or the catheters that we use becoming simpler. To give you an example, when we started doing this procedure, it was only in patients who could not have surgery or patients who had high risk for surgery. And in those patients, the complications rate, because the catheter were big, the profile was big, it was higher. Now that we have better equipment, better tools, all that has dropped significantly. So this is the beginning of a new era. I don't know what's going to happen in 20 years. Are we going to still be doing surgery in the low-risk patients? We do not have that answer yet, and we have to wait. But I think today, you asked me today, is a young patient wants to have TAVR or percutaneous approach to aortic stenosis, we have to say no. We do not have the documentation, and I think surgery is the better option because they have durability that I cannot offer.
Dr. Savage, is that what your thoughts are, the same?
Yeah, absolutely. It's exciting technology, and I do think that more and more we're going to be moving to a transcatheter approach for aortic valve replacement there. But in younger people, and the risk
to be more certain. Surgically,
well, the risk of the operation is so low in healthy, young, low-risk people that the advantage that you get, first of all, most of the valves that are put in surgically are sewn in securely. The percutaneous valves require a stent apparatus that forms around the aorta to hold it in place. There have been some problems. There's probably a few more leaks around these valves than the surgical valves, although that's been less of a problem, again, with newer technology. So I do think it's going to evolve to that. But this brings sort of an interesting concept up, because people will come into my office and they say, well, I want the catheter thing. And people will, it's the same thing for coronary disease. And, my peers who are like Dr. Caseta, where I work, we work together to try and figure out what the best thing is for the patient. So just like, Paul wanted a stent and thought he was going to get a stent, but when they really looked at things, they said, you know what, even though cardiac coronary bypass surgery is more involved, it's going to have a better long-term outcome for you, because we can't just decide, well, what is it going to be like tomorrow? I mean, clearly with a percutaneous approach, you're going to be better, you're going to be up and around faster tomorrow, but what about 5 years? What about 10 years? What's the durability of these approaches? And that's really what it comes down to. And Dr. Caseta works with his surgeon. I work with my cardiologist so that we can really find the best solution for all of these things.
So there's a term. We call it the heart team.
Yeah.
And the heart team is a multidisciplinary approach to cardiovascular disease. And I think it's one of the most important aspects of treating heart disease today. We all work as a team, and it's for the good of the patient, for the best of the patient.
Can I just share one thing?
Sure, go ahead.
And that is, because I have some kidney issues, before the surgery, I asked my kidney doctor to speak to the heart surgeon. And I said, please just confer with each other, make certain I don't come out with a good heart but a bad kidney. And they spoke to each other. Dr. Ramos spoke to Dr. Mahan, and they decided what they had to do to hydrate everything properly to make certain I was good going into the heart surgery, so I came out without a problem I wouldn't expect to have.
Right, right.
Sure.
Doctors, is the old baby aspirin a day still in effect?
Yes.
Absolutely.
No question about it.
Aspirin's a good thing.
It is.
The good outweighs the bad.
Yes.
Paul, I just wanted to ask you before we, and then we'll take the calls, how this changed you. How has it changed you?
Once again, it made me grateful. First of all, I'm grateful to doctors who really know their stuff. and that's really important. You want to go to the best. These gentlemen are the best. I went to the best. So that's number one. But personally, it changed me knowing that life's going to always throw you detours. Life's going to always throw you challenges. And you have to just put the team together and say, I still have a story to tell. I'm going forward. Let's get this past us.
Okay. We're speaking about cardiac procedures and new innovations and risk factors for heart disease. Dr. Ramon Quesada, Dr. Edward Savage, Paul Lipton, our last break, and then we'll take your calls. Stay with us.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman back with today's topical currents with Dr. Ramon Quesada, Dr. Edward Savage, and also Paul Lipton. We'll be taking some calls now. I would think, how about caller four? We'll go with that. Paul in Miami, hi.
Hi, thanks for the program. I just wondered if either of the doctors have an opinion on two ideas that are in popular books lately. One is that people who reduce the sodium in their diet too much may be at risk of of heart disease for having too low of a sodium intake. And the other idea is that people who reduce their total cholesterol blood level too much may also be at risk for heart disease. Say someone who reduces their total cholesterol blood level down to, say, below 180, something like that, may be at some sort of risk. And those were my only questions. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for calling.
So it's very thank you for the questions. They're very interesting. Number one, regarding to the sodium, the data on sodium is not totally clear. Sodium by itself, we know that diet high in sodium are not good for you because you it's one of the prones to hypertension. The first thing that we do in patients who are hypertensive is exercise and low sodium diet. We wanted them to reduce the amount of sodium intake. Unfortunately, the food that we eat regularly is full of sodium, and that's a problem. If you low in too much, which is very, very difficult to do, really, there's no corroboration with cardiovascular disease. Now, regarding to the cholesterol, we need cholesterol. When you are growing up, you need cholesterol to build proteins and to build your body. But it gets to the point that you probably don't need to build so much. And what becomes important then is the relationship. If you're an athlete, for example, and you have a HDL that is extremely high, HDL is the good cholesterol. But the good cholesterol has four particles, and only one of those particles is a good particle. If you have the high HDL, but the particles that you have are not the good particles, the ones that don't work, and your cholesterol is high, that 200 of cholesterol could become, in reality, a 400 cholesterol. And the opposite is true. And if you have a low cholesterol, but the majority of the cholesterol that you have is the bad cholesterol, is not good either, too. So you have to have a relationship. You cannot take the absolute values. That's why when you look at your numbers, you have to look at with the experts, with your doctor, and go over it before you make any decision and change in habits.
How do you know with that HDL which particles you have? It doesn't give that in your blood test information.
No, but we have tests. We do. It's like doing a map of your particles. And we don't do it routinely. We do it in patients who are high risk and have high cholesterol. The first thing we do is do the particles. So once we know the then we know the map, the your genetic map, we can treat you more properly.
Okay.
So we can treat the particles specifically.
Dr. Savage, what sort of breakfast should we eat? And do you eat?
I eat whatever I can find in my office when I'm hungry, actually. You know, there's so much out there on diet. I mean, so maybe what I... And if you want to be a pure... there are people who are pure vegan, and there's no question that people who are vegan have low cholesterol. But part of it is they're all also really thin, too, because they don't eat... Because you have to eat a lot of stuff as a vegan to get calories and protein, and actually there can be problems with protein malnutrition in some people who follow those
That's
diets.
Not too often, though, is it?
No.
Okay.
No. Very rare.
But I'm a big proponent of a low-fat protein and low-carb. Lots of fruits and vegetables. And for breakfast, I think it's fine to eat eggs because they have some fat in them. The whole egg cholesterol myth was just crazy because our bodies make much more cholesterol than you'll get in an egg. Right. But a balanced breakfast, some protein in the morning is good, some carbohydrate to get going. Don't eat, if you just eat a bagel, you're going to eat too much because the problem with just eating pure carbohydrates is that you metabolize them very quickly. Your blood pressure shoots up, your blood pressure shoots down, and then you're hungry again, and it just doesn't regulate your metabolism very well. So, but I'm not a nutrition expert. So,
okay, next caller, we have Maria in Miami. Thanks for your patience. Hi. Maria.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask the doctors, what is their take on stem cell therapy for vascular conditions?
Can either of you answer that, Dr. Kisani?
Yes. You know, stem cells are a very fascinating aspect of medicine. Can we replace our heart cells? And because the heart cells cannot be replaced, like the brain cells. You were born with some with the numbers, and you lose them, and you lose them. You don't get them back. But if you get the cell that can change to any part of the that's what a stem cells is. Cells that are undifferentiated, but they can differentiate into any specific type of cell. So that's what we're being studied. Unfortunately, in cardiovascular and heart, if you have a heart attack, all the studies with stem cells have shown really minimally improvement. There is not a conclusive evidence today that using stem cells will help you. If you have a chronic condition like your heart is totally weak because you have what we call cardiomyopathy of non-specific origin, which is the majority of the cases, and you give them stem cells, they don't work so far. And we still are in a very premature phase of evolution in this whole discipline. But in other aspects, stem cells has more future. But in cardiovascular medicine, it is being, at least in the heart part, is not being so successful so far.
Yeah. One reason that you could say that is there's a couple of components to stem cells. The stem cell itself, like the muscle cell, but you also have to have the scaffold for those things to work. Yeah. So for example, for a muscle just sitting on the table can contract, but it doesn't do anything. Why do our muscles work? Well, they start at one bone and they go to the other bone and you pull together. So if you don't have a scaffold or a way for them to reformat the scaffold that was there, that's the problem. And stem cells have been around for 20 years. And as Dr. Cassetta said, we really haven't seen any benefit from them, at least in the heart right now.
If you've had either stents put in, either the absorbable ones or the others, if you have this transcatheter aortic valve replacement, if you have open heart surgery, do you still have to watch everything you do and eat and live heart healthy as much as you did before you? I mean, can you still get in trouble if you don't?
Absolutely. To use a Monopoly analogy, this is not a get out of jail free card. And as I tell people with coronary disease, right, exactly. As I tell people with coronary disease, this is not a cure. Stents or bypass. Now, statins are not a cure, but they're clearly can slow progression and even cause regression. But this is an ongoing process. It's we're treating what most of what Dr. Quesada and I do are treat the symptoms, not the primary problem. Would you agree with that?
I totally agree with you.
All right, we have an emailer. Let's see, Paul wants to know what a Holter monitor is. What purpose it serves? A Holter monitor?
Yes, a Holter monitor is a device that you can. Initially, the initial device was only for 24 hours. You can monitor, record all your heartbeats and see if you have any arrhythmia or rhythm disturbances. Then we can do that for a week. We have now devices that we can put inside subcutaneously, and we'll monitor you for 2-3 years, and retrieve all that data and see how your heartbeats are or your rhythm is behaving. That is what is a Holter. It's like a computer chip. That's exactly what it is. And we record all your heart rhythm for a period of time. So if you have symptoms, like, for example, I've been having palpitations, okay? We examine you, we don't find anything. You do an EKG, and the electrocardiogram is normal. So you complain that you still have palpitations, then we probably will put some form of recording so we can see how you behave. It will tell you, please write down in a notebook the symptoms that you're having when you feel those palpitations. And then we go and retrieve the data of your rhythm at that particular time, and we get to know if you really have a rhythm disturbances that we call it arrhythmias.
Yeah, a good example, that's atrial fibrillation. Yes.
Right.
So that's probably the most common, and atrial fibrillation can be what's called paroxysmal, meaning it comes and goes. So if you're sitting in the office and you get an electrocardiogram at 1 minute period in time, you may not see it. But if you monitored over a period of time, usually 30 days or longer, then you'll see it and you'll be able to diagnose it and potentially treat it.
Yeah, I had, after my surgery, they had me wear that for 24 hours.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up here. Dr. Edward Savage is chairman of the Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery, Center Director for the Heart and Vascular Institute at Cleveland Clinic, Florida. And Dr. Savage is also a clinical professor at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine. Thank you so much for being here today.
Sure.
We want to mention the American Heart Association's Broward Heart Walk is April 23rd, 8 a.m., Nova Southeastern University.
Absolutely, and you can go on to the American, if you type in Broward Heart Walk, you can find the website and you can make a donation. And I'm happy to have you support the Cleveland Clinic Florida team if you'd like to.
Okay.
It's a 5K.
5K.
All right.
Dr. Ramon Quesada, Medical Director of Interventional Cardiology, Cardiac Research and Structural Heart Program at Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute at Baptist Hospital. Thank you so much for being with us.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
I hope I don't see either of you anytime.
Well, if you do, hopefully we can help you out.
I hope so.
So you can see us a lot more.
Okay. And Paul Lifton, who underwent quintuple bypass last year and wrote Hour of the Wolf, and somebody wanted to know what you would have changed, and I already know that, Mauricio, he would have written a chapter called Bypass. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Topical Currents lead producer, Richard Ives. Technical direction from Jason Zabka, who creates our online features. Polly Landis is associate producer. It's easy to download free audio archives from our website, WLRN.org. More information at the Topical Currents Facebook page, and there's the iTunes podcast. Tomorrow, our guest is the uproarious South Florida icon and author, Dave Barry. He's co-authored a new book, and it's a hoot. For This We Left Egypt.
Joe, you have to say it right.
For This We Left Egypt.
Very good.
A Passover Haggadah for Jews and those who love them. And I'm included there. It's an offbeat look at the Passover Seder. Thanks for listening. Here and now, next from NPR News.